We do not roast coffee. In fact, we let it be roasted. We are a passive pluperfect manufacturer.
Welcome back to the First Crack Podcast. I am your host, Garrick Van Buren. Thanks for hitting play. Today, I am extremely pleased to bring you a conversation with roast master Timothy Tulloch from the Minnesota-based European Roastery at euroroast.com. We talk about the roasting process, coffee roasting process, some brewing techniques, packaging techniques and technologies, and how he believes that the single-serve coffee pod that you're starting to see so everywhere, I can't avoid it, how he sees that is the future of coffee, specialty coffee, and the same sort of switch that we made in music from LP to CD. And he even drops a line on what, in all the research that he's done, what he sees as the best coffee pod brewer machine thingy. And it ain't the Senseo, folks. Music in the background that you hear right now, you can thank Jeremy Pillar for that. As always, the First Crack Podcast is a Working Pathways production, workingpathways.com. Why don't you head over to firstcrackpodcast.com? Yeah, you know, the website for the show. And comment on this conversation, grab past conversations, and rate anything you'd like. That's right, any of the shows. I've been tweaking it a little bit, so let me know what you think of the left-hand menu. All right, folks, here you go.
Product itself determines the process, rather than we as humans or computers saying this is what it should look like, this is what it should be. The end result, and I'll go into the process in a moment, the end result should be that the consumer says, wow. Absolutely. All we are looking for is the wow factor. To get the wow factor, you've got to start with the specialty green coffee, which is about 2% of world production, could be termed specialty. Then there are the parameters of how you buy the coffee, who you buy it from, where you buy it from, in terms of child labor, human rights, clinics, hospitals, housing, how they treat the people. So we tend to buy from cooperatives that are member-owned, are democratically run, and they tend to be the best model for equality or egalitarian operations. There are some areas in the world, like Hawaii, where there aren't any cooperatives, so you buy from a particular farm. So we're limited to that. So we can't say 100% is cooperative, but probably about 95% of what we buy is cooperative grown. Next thing, in the roasting, in the technology of the roasting, the first thing we do is we roast for anywhere from 18 to 26 minutes. Depends upon the coffee, depends upon the color of roast. The commercial roasters will roast in 4 minutes to 6 minutes. Batch roasting, very fast, almost like a pizza oven affair.
Because they're looking to get it nice and charred and even.
Correct. Well, they just want to get it fast through the process. The Northern German method is sort of the old way of roasting. We use Probat roasters that are... They're both 1946 and 1956. They're a few years old, but it's the old technology of roasting. So the length of time is critical. And then the airflow, we adjust the airflow during the roasting process to a particular profile that we've developed over the last 20 years of roasting, 25 years of roasting, actually. And... at the end of the roast, we turn off the baffles. We've jerry-rigged the machinery so that we turn off the airflow completely, going exit of the smoke, and the smoke is forced back into the drums. Hmm. That 2-minute smoking of the coffee changes the flavor of the coffee. It just gives it an extra oomph to it. And we've just found over the years that that's the way to do it. The other thing we do in the different in technology roasting is that we air quench, we dry cool the coffee, air cool the coffee, not wet quench. Wet quench is where you pour water as much as adding 20% to the cooling tray or into the drum itself. we don't have water anywhere near the roasters. We do not use water to quench the coffee. We don't need to because we've got 20 minutes to cool the coffee. We still cool it very fast. We have massive fans that dry the coffee or cool the coffee. They suck air from the building and they're getting ready, but we've got 18 to 26 minutes to play with. And then, so that's the three things. One is the length of time. Two is the smoking. The third is the air cooling. And the fourth is the everything that we roast today is packaged and shipped today. Again, specialty coffee has to be fresh. The average consumer does know the difference between fresh coffee and stale coffee. And no matter how you package a coffee, it is going to go stale in about 3 weeks. I don't care what you say and how much nitrogen we try to put in. It might maintain the coffee, its integrity of being good, but not fresh, will be lost after 3 weeks.
Wow, that's longer. That's three times longer than I give it. So I've noticed a difference in, you know, just inside a week of whole bean in a Tupperware, you know, kept at room temperature.
If you store the coffee where it has access to air, then you're going to have degradation within 8 days. What happens is the coffee continues to roast for about 4 days after we have finished roasting it. It continues to roast. Mm-hmm. It gives out volatile gases for 4 days. That is why, in order to have fresh coffee in a bag, the coffee has to be put into a valve with one-way valve. If you don't, it would blow up. When we started the specialty industry back in the 80s, the only way we could get coffee into people's hands, specialty coffee, was to put it into bins and try and move those bins in the independent coffee shops as fast as we could. We couldn't put specialty coffee into a tin because it would explode. The way coffee is put into a tin is simply it's degassed in the factory for 5 days, swirled around in big tanks. Coffee dies, and they put it into a tin, and then that's it. When you open the tin, it's the last dying gasp of the coffee, the last dying gasp. What was revolutionary for us in the 80s was the Italians came up with a little valve, which was a one-way valve, to put on a flexible bag, so we were able to put coffee while it's still hot from the roaster into the bag, seal it, let it keep roasting in the bag, giving off the gases, so that the end result is the consumer has a coffee that is as fresh as it was right out of the roaster.
Up until that point, it was a matter of finding a roaster that is in your neighborhood and making sure that they roasted, the beans that you purchased were roasted within the last day or so you had the maximum amount of time for the fresh coffee.
That's correct. And it's, in a way, we did a disservice to our industry by having bins because it's still taking time to convince consumers not to buy coffee out of a bin. It is not as fresh. You don't know how long it's been there. It is better to buy coffee out of a flexible bag with a valve, where the integrity of the roaster is there and maintained and it looks good, mm-hmm. The coffee itself. When you're looking at coffee, you're looking at the size of the bean. Size matters in terms of uniformity, great largeness. And then you can look at the beans, and if you see pitting or little black spots, then it's roasted too fast, it was crackled. If it's roasted unevenly in terms of too fast, again, you'll have the inside will be lighter than the outside, and if we're going to different taste profile, you'll get a sourness and a grassiness in the coffee. So going back to the technology of roasting, in a way we bake the coffee, we let it be baked because of the length of time, but that allows us to heat the whole structure of the bean to get a uniform coloration of the coffee. Now going back to this passive manufacturing, after every day of roasting, we will cup everything that we've roasted, test it out. We do not roast to a color, we roast to a development, which is determined, the ultimate development, which is determined by the cupping. Cupping table is key to an operation. So we cup the coffee, we determine then, well, did we get it right? For this particular arrival of coffee, for this crop, this week's coffee, have we got it right? Are we bringing out the best? And then we might tweak it a wee bit for the next day or whatever, or keep it the same if it's great. so that we are constantly on our toes to find a fully developed optimum degree of roast.
You get a new bean in, one that you haven't had in the European roastery before. How do you determine where that initial point is?
We have sample roasters where we sample roast the coffees at different degrees, different time temperature changes, different air flows, timing, and then we put it on the cupping table. We blind cup. We get a panel of people from the roastery who will cup the coffee blind, not knowing what's been done, and then find their preference. And then you find the majority preference, and then from that we say, okay, let's aim for that. Then as we keep roasting, then we bring in the coffee, or we start roasting it by the bag, and then it's a matter of keeping on our toes to make sure that it is, we, in our initial assessment of the coffee, was correct. Then it's this customer feedback. Then you ask customers, well, how did you like it? What was it like? Is there anything we should do to change how we roasted it? And you'll get comments like, well, it's a little too grassy, or it's a little too carbonated, or it's too much caramel in it, or not enough caramel in it. And then we'll tweak the roasting, because we're going through this very complex curve. When you put green coffee in a roaster, it's the most amazing reaction that's going on inside the chamber. Complex reaction that is happening, you'd never imagine. There's 3,000 chemical calloids in coffee. 450 molecular structures alone. So it's a very, very complex product. So that adding the heat is changing it dramatically.
What do you like today? What's the most interesting coffee that you have in this warehouse today?
The Malawi for this year is fantastic. Last year we had incredible Guatemalas. Guatemala had a good crop. There were just exceptional coffees coming out of there. Over the years it changes. It used to be back in the early days of the 70s and 80s that Kenya had the niche of the best specialty coffee. Unfortunately, things changed. Yeah, you've got to realize that coffee is a third world agricultural commodity.
Sure.
So it is subject to the vagaries of management, how well the coffee's horticultural practices, how well it's picked, how well it's sorted before it's even put into the fermentation tanks, how it's fermented, how it's dried. You know, we all our coffee's sun-dried. We don't like any kiln drying, simply because we don't need to use wood that's valuable, can be used elsewhere.
So there's kiln-dried, there's sun-dried, and then there's also the monsooned.
That's particular to Indian coffees. It was found by mistake in India, southern India, in Mysore. This is back 100 years ago, 200 years ago. They had coffee that was stored in open warehouses, just with a roof but no sides. And the monsoon rains would come sleeting in, it would drench the coffee, and then it would dry again, then would drench the coffee, and then dry again. And they had this shipment go off to Europe, and they found that, actually there was a certain taste profile in monsoon coffee. And so really what monsoon coffee is, you dry it, you wet it, you dry it, you wet it, you dry it, you wet it.
One of the things that, to be completely honest, shocked me and stunned me is that you are very aggressively pursuing potted coffee. And I mentioned this when we first met, is that to me that's a hard sell, because it's, at this point anyway, complete garbage that's being packaged into pods. And for someone like you to put good quality coffee, especially coffee, in these things, to know that in an office or setting or whatever, I can get a decent cup of coffee is fairly impressive.
The pod, or let's call it the single cup on demand coffee sector, is new. It erupted in Holland 2 years ago, and within a year, 26% of the Dutch market is now pod. European pod coffee has been very successful. Consumers have taken on to it because of the whole thing of the choice, no mess, no wastage, 24-hour, you choose. It's a great program. We looked at it about 12 years ago at a time when there were just pods that were put into espresso pods, and we just couldn't get a freshness. It would go stale. The espresso pods would go stale. So it's like, well, there's no way we can get really good coffee in a pod, in a bag, and keep it fresh. Then, and what was available in the market right now in the U.S., is coffee that is, a lot of it is roasted in Europe. It's very stale, and it, in general, it uses between 7 and 9 grams of coffee per throw. And when we started doing our own analysis of how we should do this, we found that we had to use 11 grams in order to get a 25% total dissolved solid extraction from the coffee, or a net of 1,200 parts per million solids. To obtain that, we need 11 grams, and we had to use a fairly coarse grind. And to keep the freshness, we had to reduce the oxygen from 21% to 2%. We actually try and get 1.6%. Most of our coffee has 1.6, but it's, we guarantee below 2% oxygen level in the bag itself, which is really an inert atmosphere. So all the pods are individually wrapped. They're not bulk wrapped or put into a bag that is, doesn't even get sealed. So each pod is individually wrapped, so that is real specialty. 11 grams, it's a lot of coffee. It still works in all the coffee brewers, for the pod brewers that you can find at the big department chain stores. We found, you know, varying success, so much so that I would say that our best retail brewer is the Black & Decker, then the Melita, and then the Seiko doesn't do too well. And the reason why is because of the temperature of the water is not very hot. Temperature of the water is critical.
And that's the issue with any home consumer level brewer, is whether or not the coffee, the water gets hot enough to actually brew the coffee.
That is always, many people say, well, you know, they go into a coffee shop and say, I take your coffee home and I make it at home and it never tastes as good as it does in the store. Why? And that is simply because of water extract. The temperature of the water that a commercial brewer is hotter. It's about 195 to 205, whereas a home brewer, just from UL approval, can't be above that. It has to be, you know, more like 170, 165, which isn't really hot enough to get the correct extraction. Now, there are certain makes, such as the Krups and the Braun, that do the pulsating, and they do come out at 195. But your lower-end models just don't have the water extraction of the coffee, so you're not getting your gold cup standard. The answer is the pods, because if you can get a machine that has 190, 195 degrees temperature, extracts with pulsating, and it takes 20 seconds to 30 seconds to extract the coffee, and you get this fantastic coffee that is has all the attributes of a gold cup standard from a brewed machine. And if you look at the consumption habits of most consumers in the home, it's one cup, maybe two cups in the morning before they go to work, and within the home, different people like different things, and that's where the pods fulfill that.
The win to me is that I can get much more exotic, much more interesting, much more niche and small crops from interesting places more readily than I would be able to otherwise.
Because the pod program is new, right now I think we have 15 different origins or types of blends of coffee that are available in the pods. That will expand as the pods get accepted into the mass market or into the specialty market.
Sure.
The specialty industry has not yet embraced the pods because it's so new.
Right.
It's so unknown.
It seems fairly high investment to switch, you know, going from LP to CD here for the same thing.
The brewers you can get from the department source like for $30, the pod brewers, and they are the CD from the conversion from, as you say, from the LP to the CD. And I think it's, we had a revolution in the U.S. when we went from percolated coffee, or let's go back 100 years to cowboy coffee, made in over the fire in the pan, and you threw the coffee in, and if you were in Minnesota, you'd throw an egg in. Then you went to the percolated coffee. 1950s, that started to change to the brewed coffee with a filter. And then it went from the brewed coffee with a glass carafe that burnt on a burning plate. It went, then the next step was the air pot, or the thermos brewers. That was revolutionary. That came in the mid late 90s. So I think the revolution for this decade is going to be the pods. That is a coffee revolution.
You're offering European roastery pods now.
Yes, we have European roastery pods available on the site, euroroast.com. It's going very well. People are realizing that it is better coffee. It is exceptionally good coffee. Until the last couple of decades, coffee was just a desk accessory. It has taken a great deal of education, of promotion, to convince people that actually coffee is like wine. It has wonderful nuances. Every country of origin has different characteristics. Every blend of coffee has a different profile of taste. And it is as complex in terms of its satisfaction to the palate as wine is. And so I think coffee is now up there as being treated with the same respect as a grape. And I think that can only lead to further sophistications of the consumer. The consumer says, wow, you know, I had a fantastic Malawian coffee or a Zambian coffee, and it's so different from a Kenya. Even if it's from East Africa, it's huge differences. Or buying a high-end Colombian Supremo that is well-roasted and everything else, has a certain profile of taste of, you know, toasted overtones and some caramel tones that is unique to Colombia. You go to Sumatra, buying Sumatran coffee, very earthy. It's almost like drinking a sandbox. But it has that fullness and the natural earthiness that you don't get in other coffees. I think the specialty industry has concentrated on these exotic origins, which is wonderful. It opens up people's tour of the world through the coffee cup.
So is somebody like Starbucks good or bad for that?
Starbucks has been wonderful because they have brought specialty coffee into mainstream thinking. Every Hollywood star is carrying a coffee cup that says Starbucks on it. They talk about cappuccinos and lattes and the whole culture of, you know, skinny no fun, dip chocolate, you know, whatever it is. It's created a culture. Now, part of the success of specialty coffee is that it is a cultural movement away from alcoholic beverages, away from the smoky bars, to being a meeting point, meeting place, a social interaction.
Is the lack of that unique to America? Because that to me seems, you know, traditionally European, that those places would always exist on the continent.
Coffee shops, you know, you go to any European country, coffee shops have been around for hundreds of years. Hundreds and hundreds of years. I think the most famous ones are like in St. Mark's Square in Venice. But I think it needed the impetus and the bludgeoning of the large chain stores to really bring it into mainstream thinking. Until the chain stores emerged in the 90s, it was a very hard struggle because it was a bunch of Boy Scout roasters and independent coffee shops that had sawdust on the floor and were dedicated and very passionate, but only could reach a very limited audience.
You would have to educate every single one of their customers.
One by one, person by person, day by day. And so now, because of the whole culture of specialty coffee is mainstream, people aren't as afraid to go into a coffee shop and ask for a latte with double shot or a quadruple shot of espresso and add a little bit of mocha into it and whatever else is, tickles their fancy.
Where does that put the independent coffee shop, the people that have been, that are passionate about selling good, interesting coffees?
Very hard for an independent coffee shop to compete with the brand imaging of the larger chains. But with the success we've had of the stores which we supply, it is based upon hand selling. Still the hand selling, the personal touch. The owner, manager, staff that are dedicated, that get to know their customers, develop a loyalty, have a referral net system kick in, dedicated to quality, give feedback to us as the roaster. Very similar to the independent bookstore industry.
Sure, that where Borders and Barnes & Noble walked in and the same effect happened.
Correct. And the independent bookstores that have survived are the ones that are absolutely dedicated to hand selling, where every staff person has read half the books on the shelf and so you can go in and say, well, what should I read now? And it's almost like that with the coffee stalls. Independent coffee shops that are still successful are the ones that people come in and the staff know about the coffees, they are passionate about them, they understand them, they taste them, they cup them.
Timothy, thank you for the conversation. Everyone out there listening, thank you. Thank you for spending this bit of your day with me and with the First Crack Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it was interesting. Let me know. Again, firstcrackpodcast.com for comments and ratings, and firstcrack@gmail.com for email. Head over to euroroast.com to check out their coffees. I have very much been enjoying their Malawi these days. That'll do it. Have a great day. Bye.